Yep, I can hear you.
Good, thank you.
40 states, the District of Columbia, and Guam?
I know.
Guam? Remember the issue with Guam?
I'm gonna call this meeting to order.
Yes.
Let the record show that the meeting of HESS was called to order at 3:04 on February 3rd, 2004. And the members present were Representative Godel, Wolf, Coghill, Seaton, Cisna, and myself, Representative Wilson. And Representative Seaton will be leaving our meeting in about 30 minutes?
25.
25, so we'll try to get as far as we can before he leaves. Today, we are going to be hearing two bills. House Bill 337, an act relating to anatomical donation registry, and House Bill 306 regarding optometrists' use of pharmaceuticals. The first bill we will hear is House Bill 337. The current version of this bill is Committee Substitute House Bill 337 Version U, and that is behind tab 1 in your notebook. And this legislation will create a donor registry program, which the donor's Alaska driver's license ID information can be transferred to Life Alaska Donor Services and the state's donor tissue program. So along with Liesl McGuire, I want to mention that several of us on the committee have already co-sponsored this. My fellow HESS committee members, Gatto, Seaton, and Kapsner, and myself are co-sponsors. So Representative McGuire, would you like to go into what this is all about?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the HESS committee. Thank you so much for hearing this bill today and having it right up at the top of the schedule. I know you have a lot of hard work to do today. I'll be brief. I think the biggest statement that I could make is that almost all of you are co-sponsors of the bill. And that tells me that you understand what it is and you understand its importance. And so I don't want to bore you with the details of which you already have come to believe in. But just for the public record, I want to note one thing, which is that the new CS reflects just one change, Madam Chairman, and that is on page 2. If you look at line 19, what you see is a subsection B now that just simply restates what was in the old section C and deletes the old section B. And that old section B was a registry must include only residents of the state of Alaska. So just to be clear, on page 2, there's a new B because the old B was just simply removed. And actually, I want to say thank you to Representative Seaton. It was through a line of questioning that he drew out during the state affairs hearing that we discovered that it was actually unnecessary to have language in there and possibly confusing, because we can in fact have a registry that includes residents and non-residents. So I want to thank Representative Seaton for that. In a nutshell, this bill is going to save lives. It is brought about by a lot of hard work by the Life Alaska, the Life Center Northwest, many physicians and nurses across the state of Alaska, and it comes to you with a lot of hard work put into it. Life Alaska created the first organ and tissue donor registry back in 2001, and so it exists. So we do have a donor registry in the state of Alaska. The only problem, Madam Chair, is that most people in the state of Alaska don't know how to get their information to that registry. It's not a well-known fact. We went through this in state affairs. When you go to the Division of Motor Vehicles right now, they ask you if you want to be an organ and tissue donor, and many Alaskans agree to do that. You may get a sticker on your driver's license or even get a little card, but unless you transfer that information yourself to the Life Alaska registry, it will not become a part of that database. And so unless your driver's license is on your person at the time of an accident, there is no way for the responders to know that you're in fact an organ and tissue donor. And what a travesty, because if you really are and that's your intent, you could have saved a life. So what this bill does is it authorizes the Department of Motor Vehicles to transfer information from a person who voluntarily decides to be a member of the organ and tissue donor registry. So, and then just to be clear, so that everyone understands with privacy and everything else, and obviously personal choice, when you go into the DMV, you have basically three options. One is you can decline it and say you don't want to be one, and that's absolutely your right. The second thing is you could decide that you do want to be one, but you don't want to be part of the registry, that you just simply want to say as one indication of your will that you want to be an organ and tissue donor and have that sticker on your license but not be part of the registry. The third option is the one that I hope Alaskans will do, and this bill, a similar bill passed in Washington State, and what we saw is an 86% increase in those folks that are part of the registry. I expect to see the same thing from Alaskans. And that third option is you sign up for it and then you become part of the registry, and allow yourself to give the gift of life to someone else. There are protections in the bill, Madam Chair, that make it clear that privacy should be protected, that any misuse of the registry itself will result in a criminal penalty. Testimony from Jill Steinhaus from Life Centers Northwest and folks at Life Alaska will tell you that that's never occurred. So we don't envision problems, but we want to make sure that the legislation guards against any of those possible abuses. The bill has one other component to it, Madam Chair, and what it does is it creates a donate a dollar program. And the Division of Motor Vehicles, I also want to publicly thank Dwayne Bannock, who is the director. He worked with our interim working group steadily and agreed to do this. And so what will happen is at the time that you're asked if you want to be an organ and tissue donor, you also can make a decision to donate $1 to the Organ and Tissue Donation Awareness Fund. And what that does is it helps fund the brochures that are printed that inform people about what organ and tissue donation is. And I don't know if any of you got one of these in your recent electric bill. I did with Chugach Electric, but they also print out things in your utility bill sometimes that just let you know, do you know organ and tissue donation saves lives, and some of the facts about it, how you can register and things like that. So that's what that money goes toward, and again, it's perfectly voluntary, and you don't have to. As I mentioned, similar bills have already passed in Washington and Montana in 2003 and have been successful already. And the final thing to note is that we're changing to a new license system in the state of Alaska. That's an exciting new thing that's happening. So when you get your new, what they call a digital driver's license, it won't be in the plastic coating like we had before. It'll be kind of more like a credit card. If you agree to do this, rather than the sticker that gets kind of rubbed off over the years, you'll have a heart that actually goes into the driver's license itself so that people will know you're registered. And then I guess just a legal note, what we have found is this is the best possible way to convey your wishes to your family and in a final legal way. The way before where people were going into the DMV and getting a sticker, getting a card, but not registering creates all kinds of problems there too. The potential for your family members to contest whether or not that was really your will or not. It might be one indication of your wishes, but since you're not in the registry, does that really mean that you changed your mind later and so on? So this is the best, most legal way of doing it, and I hope members support it, and thank you for your co-sponsorship.
Okay. Next, we'll hear testimony from Jill Steinhaus, who is director of the development for Life Center Northwest. And Jill is waiting online. So are you there, Jill?
I am, Madam Chairperson. Thank you.
Go right ahead, Jill, and we'd like to hear your comments.
Well, Madam Chairperson and members of the committee, for the record, I am Jill Steinhaus, and am representing Life Center Northwest, who in collaboration with Life Alaska provides organ procurement services in Alaska, and really representing McGuire hit all the salient points. This legislation, with your support, helps more Alaskans to be able to make their wishes about donation known and ensures that we're able to save more lives. As Representative McGuire stated, last year this process passed in both Washington and Montana, and for the last 6 months of 2003, we had 135 organ donors. 106 of them were the direct result from the donor designation or registry system. So I'm confident that if you push this process through and we have the opportunity to implement it in Alaska this year, we'll see a significant increase in the number of lives saved. And I'm open to answering questions, but just wanted to affirm what Representative McGuire has said, and thank you again for your consideration.
Thank you, Jill. Anybody on the committee have any questions for Jill? Okay. We also have Dr. Bradford. Oh, nope, that's for a different bill. Let's see. Okay, let's see. Any more? Okay, is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify on this bill, on House Bill 337? Okay. Is there anyone else online that would like to testify? Are there any questions or comments from the committee members? Representative Coghill?
This would be for the sponsor of the bill. I see the question that was put on the fiscal note from Health and Social Services. Looks to me like Department of Motor Vehicles would be handling the information as it comes in, and there was a question left by Jenna Clark of Health and Social Services that they didn't know that they would be a part of it. They didn't anticipate a fiscal note, but that raised the question in my mind, Representative McGuire, as to the management of the fund itself and the donation program. Is it your anticipation that the Department of Motor Vehicles then would administer this, or who?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, yeah, the Division of Motor Vehicles would be the collector that would then forward that money on to Life Alaska, and that was part of the reason why we had to spend so much time talking about that over the summer. With respect to the Department of Health and Human Services, the only role that we anticipate at all for them is certifying those organ and tissue donation centers that would be eligible to participate in the registry and to be classified as such. Under an earlier version of the bill, we ended up just saying a procurement organization, and we went through various iterations of how we would define it, and we ultimately decided that it would be best that we keep the Department of Health and Human Services as that department that would make that delineation. And so that's the only role that we envision.
Madam Chair?
Follow up.
And to follow along that line of questions, and I'm sorry I didn't catch this in State Affairs, but
okay.
Just with regard to the fund itself, you have those who are going to become those people that can actually apply to the fund. There's going to be a cost involved to them, as I understand. That range, is it Health and Human Services? Is it the hospitals? Who is it? Doctors? Can you give me who is going to be dealing with the fund? I thought I was on the right page, but with regard to using the information from the registry is kind of what I was getting at. I'm sorry. There was going to be a cost that would go into the fund from those who would use the registry. It took me a minute to get back to my question. I'm sorry. But I think I saw in here that those who use the registry, and my understanding then that would be hospitals, doctors, health and social services people,
please.
They would be assessed something. Is that what you were envisioning on this?
No, that's not what we're envisioning at all. Through the chair, Representative Coghill, we're not envisioning any cost to anybody accessing the registry for those who are qualified to do so. In fact, one of the reasons we put into place the Donate a Dollar program is to help offset the costs of maintaining the registry.
And let me just read you, if I may interrupt.
Sure.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. The one that caught my attention was on page 2, line 27 and 28, that procurement organization that has requested registry information, the department shall pay the reasonable costs associated with the creation by the organization of a registry and reasonable costs. And I was just kind of curious who those would be.
Through the chair, Representative Coghlan, my understanding is that...
Did you give your name and...
Well, I'm sorry, this is Heath Hilliard, staff, Representative McGuire, attempting to respond to that question. My understanding with the registry costs is there will be a certain administrative cost associated with the setup and establishment of the registry. This is distinct from the Donate a Dollar Fund and the Anatomical Gift Awareness Fund, which that Anatomical Gift Awareness Fund is there primarily designed for the cost of production associated with marketing materials associated with the program, associated with pushing it through the Department of Motor Vehicles. This talks about who is responsible for the cost of the establishment of the registry. Ultimately, and I think there was some question or debate with regard to whether or not some of the proceeds from the Anatomical Gift Awareness Fund could go back to help the organization offset some of its costs. I can't answer that with absolute clarity at this point in time, but the main intent of the fund and the Donate a Dollar program is for supplementation of the marketing program as a whole.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that answer. However, you know, when we start messing with budgets, Ronnie, every time a dollar changes hand, I want to make sure I know, I understand who's doing the changing and who's going to be accountable for that dollar.
Absolutely.
I still don't quite understand that from your answer.
Through the chair, Representative Coghlan, perhaps Jill Steinhaus from My Center Northwest can answer that with a little bit more clarity than we can.
Jill, are you still online with us?
I am, and Madam Chairperson, I would be happy to address that. Representative Ponkell, through the chair, what I believe I'm hearing you ask is who is responsible for, let's see, page 2, line 27, 28, and essentially that is the legalese language that we needed to include in the bill to ensure that the Alaska state government will not be responsible for funding the registry versus the procurement organizations that provide services in Alaska will be responsible. Simply, that means the organization I represent, My Center Northwest, is going to pay 100% of the development cost to get this system up and running and to maintain this system in Alaska.
And Madam Chair, so then as I understand it, it actually is a fee for service, and I understand that you're going to carry the weight of that. I wanted to find out if it was a billing authority or... I appreciate that answer. That helped me understand it. So is that fee for service that you anticipate would be the billing process?
Representative Cockell, to the chair, yes. I believe that I have not had the opportunity to speak in depth with Duran Vanek at this time, but we will collectively identify a billing process that does not impact the Department of Licensing, but does get the billing taken care of as pretty much as quickly as the funds are needed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I believe that we have Duane Bannock on the line. Duane, do you want to make any comments on that?
Thank you, Representative Wilson. I will. We at the Division of Motor Vehicles will be responsible for the actual creation for the data transmission. We have estimated this number to be approximately $7,000. I've been in contact with Jill and Life Center Northwest and to tell them that that is what our estimated costs are going to be. And so the end result is there will be no net financial cost to the state of Alaska as a result of that section.
Thank you, Duane.
Okay. Hope that clears up.
Thank you. Representative Cisna?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm trying to get a handle on this. It sounded as if the Department of Health and Social Services is going to be involved in this in some way, and if I'm correct, DOT is going to be collecting the money, and Department of Administration is named in here, because I, on page 3, line Well, everything after, I guess, line 12, discussing the monetary donation program, it talks about the department, and then in definitions it says the department would be administration. So that doesn't make sense to me. But anyway, the department will collect the money and shall ask each applicant for a motor vehicle document, whether the applicant is interested, and whether the applicant is interested. And then on line 22, each procurement or air organization, and I'm not quite sure who, I mean, it's spelling out some really detailed things here, and I'm not clear if we're talking one department or more than one department, and if, in fact, there's this collecting going on. One of the things that we're doing right now is we're doing a lot of cutting. And every one of these employees has a whole lot of things they're trying to do. I'm trying to figure out if we've scared out how we're going to make sure that our employees don't go screaming off every night at the end of the day because they've been trying to do all these different things.
Through the chair, Representative Sisna. It's not as complicated as it appears. Unfortunately, you know how these things go. When you submit them to legal drafting and you tell them what it is you want, they come back and they tell you, this is the way it has to be in order for it to be legal. The reason that the Department of Administration is mentioned is because the Division of Motor Vehicles is under the umbrella of the Department of Administration.
Okay.
So as Mr. Bannock indicated and as Ms. Steinhaus indicated, it's the Division of Motor Vehicles that will be the collector of the money and who will maintain the registry. So that's why you see Department of Administration. So just to be clear on that. And with respect to the Department of Health and Human Services, actually, we were just talking a funny thing that keeps getting confused here. It's actually the United States Department of Health and Social Services that will be making the determination in only one section of the bill, and that is as to whether or not you qualify as a procurement organization that is able to fit into the matrix of this bill and able to be a tissue and organ donor. And Jill can tell you why, but it's very, very important that when it comes to organ and tissue donation that we make sure that these centers apply through the Department of Health and Social Services and actually go check out, if you will. We don't want people just setting up shop and so on. And you can imagine all the reasons why, and I don't think I need to go into much more detail. But so there is no state Department of Health and Social Services impact, and there is only Department of Administration impact to the extent of the Division of Motor Vehicles. Now, with respect to staffing and so on, it's a very good question. And that's why Dwayne Bannock had to be involved from the very beginning. Had to think it through and really come to the ultimate conclusion that this was something that the employees and that he were willing to do so long as the costs were paid for by the procurement organizations. Again, we did not want a fiscal note. We did not want to incur more costs for the state of Alaska, particularly in these tight fiscal times. So it is offset. The staff, according to Dwayne, and he can describe it to you, but when you go in to get your driver's license, you're already presented with a series of questions. So that's an action that already occurs. What we're merely doing is adding on to it an additional question. So to the extent that that requires more effort, it's negligible. So that's what's going on there, and I apologize, Madam Chair, I misspoke about how those costs were paid. I thought it was through the donated dollar, and it is not. The procurement organization has different methods of raising money and different funding, and they pay for that. The donated dollar program does simply go, as Heath said, toward marketing, if you will, of the program, information awareness campaign. So my apologies for misspeaking on that.
Representative Seaton?
No, I'm just
stretching.
Ready to go.
Representative McGuire, I have a question. On page 4, line 16, it says the procurement organization means a person licensed, accredited, or approved under the laws of the state. And if I'm confused, but So my concern is, if you said it was the United States Department that was...
Okay, I'm just told that the original version had that and that this version does not, so it is the state. So my apologies.
You know what? It really needs to be... We could probably fix that afterwards, maybe. Do you want to... brief it, Lisa. Why don't you come up here?
I'm very, very sorry.
But this would be
What I've decided to do. We're back to business here. What I've decided to do here is that we're going to table the bill for a while. They're going to do some thinking and talking, and we're just going to move forward with the next bill. And if they are ready to do anything by the time we're done with the next bill, we'll go back to that bill. I think that there's some things that they need to check out, and so we'll give them time to do that. And so what we'll do then is to go back and bring House Bill 306, an act relating to the use of pharmaceutical agents by optometrists. We'll bring that bill forward. This bill has been back and forth in the Alaska legislature in some version or another for many, many years. Back and forth, back and forth. I've had both sides in my office today. I think this is another bit of a tricky bill. We'll see how if the questions are asked that I feel comfortable with during this process, we will continue with this bill. And if all the questions aren't asked or answered satisfactorily, we may hold this bill for a little bit too. So we'll see what's going to happen. So the question before us today, and I want you to all make sure you understand really what this is all about. It's whether or not optometrists should be allowed to prescribe oral medications to treat a patient's eye, according to the sponsor statement, to treat a patient's eyes or for an allergic reaction. And so professional testimony in the room, we have a Dr. Cheryl Lentfer and a doctor, then Dr. Bennett. And so what I will do is let Representative Samuels explain the bill to us, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you stated, HB 306 would allow optometrists to prescribe non-topical medications to treat a patient's eyes or for an allergic shock reaction. There are a dangerous list of drugs that optometrists' bill would not allow. Schedule 1A in statute, which should be in your packet, all including morphine, oxycodone, and a whole lot of things that I can't pronounce here. And I'm sure some of the doctors on either side of the argument can tell you what those particular drugs do, but it doesn't open the door wide open here. 40 other states and around 85% of the population of the United States would be covered under, is covered currently under this type of system right now. There have been no reported problems that we could find over the past 32 years. As healthcare changes across the country with reduced costs and expanded coverage attempts, look at the map, which is also in your packets. You'll notice that what I call the free range states, all the western states here in blue, they're all covered. The only state that it is west of the Mississippi that is not covered under this type of system is Hawaii. So the ones that are not covered are more of the high population, high density states where you probably have a higher number of ophthalmologists. And of all of the states, we by far dwarf the problem of having so much land mass, so few doctors, and so little accessibility to a healthcare system. So the other 40 states, and I say about 85% of the population in the United States, is covered under the system which we're proposing right here. In 92, Alaska was the 32nd state to authorize prescriptions of therapeutic drugs to treat eye diseases, and the compromise at the time was topicals only. there have been no complaints to the Alaska Board in the last 12 years. You're going to hear arguments about the changes or the differences in education between optometrists and ophthalmologists, and another chart which you have in your packet. The comparison which strikes out to me is the dentists. If every time that you went to go have a filling done, if you then had to go, you need a filling there, you've got a cavity, and you had to go see an oral surgeon because they have gone to prescribe the Novocaine, it wouldn't be very good public policy. And they have exactly the same amount of training, the dentists and the optometrists do. And now also with the ability to prescribe, we have PAs, physician's assistant. You're not required to have an undergraduate degree. An advanced nurse practitioner can prescribe, and that's 2 years of postgraduate college. Podiatrists and dentists, same licensure requirements. You require an undergraduate degree and 4 years of further schooling. All of those can prescribe. So everybody that's in the same boat educational-wise and prescribe, save one, save the optometrist. And in a state such as Alaska, where we have to travel such long distances, it makes more sense to me that we would allow the optometrist to do so. If you wholeheartedly are opposed to this, then I would think that following that logic, that you would think that PAs can no longer prescribe, or that advanced nurse practitioners can no longer prescribe, or that dentists can no longer prescribe. So we've got a situation here where you've got the educational level is the same, and yet the ability to do their job is quite different. You gave a little bit of a history, Madam Chair, on the history of the bill. In 2000, out of the entire legislature, it passed through both bodies and only had two votes against this, and then was vetoed by then-Governor Knowles. And in the next legislature, the previous legislature, this one, passed out of the House and didn't make it through the Senate. Bill's good for all Alaskans. I feel very strongly. I got pitched on this bill last year to carry this bill, and I did quite a bit of research before I agreed to put my name on the bill, because in the areas of the state outside of the road system, the accessibility to good health care is sometimes marginal at best, and I think we should afford all Alaskans the opportunity to get the most health care that they can get, given their circumstances of where they live. And I'm sure the doctors, like I said, on both sides of this issue that are sitting behind me can answer a lot of more technical questions. But that kind of gives you some of the background, some of the history in the other states. I guess, and keep going back to, if you were a citizen, if you're an Alaskan citizen and you were anywhere in the western United States, you wouldn't have to go to doctor visits to get the prescription. You don't have to go to one, but when you come back home, now the rules change. I can try to answer some of the questions. Probably.
Any questions? Well, I will go ahead and have some more testimony then. Michael Bennett, Benton? Bennett? From here in Juneau. Michael, would you come forward and state your name and affiliation and give us your testimony?
Okay, I'm Michael Bennett. I'm an optometrist in Juneau. Practice out in the valley by the airport. And speaking on behalf of optometry.
Okay.
As an advocate for this legislation. I think that Representative Samuels did a good job of talking about educational levels. Optometrists have been trained in optometry schools for about 20 years now in prescribing of oral medications. For many years have been able to do that for their patients when you're in school, and in many states this has been a gradual thing. It didn't happen in all 40 states all at once, but you know, in most of those states it's been quite some time, and some of them just much more recently in the last couple of years. The way the situation works now, if we see a patient, which, you know, primary care optometry sees the vast majority of patients in Alaska, and that patient does not need medical care, everything's fine. If that patient needs medical eye care, which can be covered or dealt with topical pharmaceuticals, law allows us and we are easily able to treat that. If the patient needs advanced surgical care, then the patient's referred to a surgeon for that. There's the small minority of patients that require oral pharmaceuticals, and this, I want to be real clear about that. It's not like most eye care patients require oral pharmaceuticals. It's far less common than topicals or eye drops are. But there are certain conditions, certain types of bacterial infections of the eyelid, certain viral infections like shingles or other things that can affect the eyelid, that or somebody who's in a lot of pain because they've had a corneal abrasion or got poked in the eye. People will frequently, you treat the condition, and they'll frequently ask you for pain medication, and you're not able to deliver that. So it's really a small percentage of cases, but there are significant inconveniences and troubles that arise for that patient when you're not able to handle that. The way it works now, you've got really a couple of choices, and I'm speaking of in Juneau, you've got really a couple of choices. One is you can refer them to an eye surgeon if you can get a hold of them or get them in, but that's not going to be that day. The other is you can call their primary care physician and see if they will prescribe the medication for them, which is awkward and uncomfortable for the physician who's not seeing the patient with the condition or does not have the training necessary to really make that judgment on their own. In rural Alaska, of course, the situation's a whole lot worse. Many communities in rural Alaska have got primary care optometrists, but virtually none of them have got eye surgeons to help out with these situations. So what typically happens there, my partner practiced for 3 years in Kotzebue, and she was the only eye care practitioner in Northwest Alaska, and she handled all of these situations but had to go to the physician's assistant to actually for the writing of the prescription. That's aside from being awkward for the practitioners, it's needless time for the patient. If it results in a delay in treatment, that's certainly not good patient care. If it results in another office visit to a different practitioner, that's added expense and inconvenience for the patient, as well as delay in treatment, and added expense for the patient's employer and their insurance company, and ultimately all of us, as well as additional time missed from work to do that. So I feel strongly that this will result in better patient care. A little bit of history on it, we've, as Representative Samuels pointed out.
Excuse me, Representative Coghill.
Well, you can sure go to the history. There are some questions that I'll have as soon as he gets them.
Okay, I'll be real brief here. We've had topicals for quite some time. That's governed by an optometry board. There has not been a single instance of a complaint brought to the optometry board in that 12-year period regarding our use of topical medications. And the same scary scenarios had been posited by some people opposed to that legislation as they're being proposed now. Malpractice rates have not changed in states that have enacted any of these legislations. Malpractice rates for optometry is extremely low, almost unbelievably low. I think that speaks to the fact that we are not a reckless profession and trying to go beyond our licensure or our knowledge. If there were a lot of optometrists prescribing things that they had no business prescribing and treating conditions they had no business treating, I think you'd see them getting sued. And you just really don't see that. Malpractice rates are no different in states that have enacted legislation like this than there are in states like Alaska that don't have that. There is not, none of the insurance carriers differentiate. So the insurance carriers are certainly not afraid of a rush of problems arising from that. So basically that's really all I want to cover. Did you have a question?
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Coghill.
Just on the face of the bill, I wanted somebody that could explain to me a couple of the terms. And I'm sorry, maybe Representative Samuel can give you the front copy of the bill, but on the Section 2, there are a couple of things in, with regard to specific medical terms. I think it would be helpful if you would define to us, and that is the ocular disease, adnexal, and the anaphylaxis.
Okay. Ocular disease is pretty self-explanatory. That's the eye itself, which really is almost not applicable for oral treatment, or not frequently, certainly. Ocular adnexal disease refers to conditions that are affecting the tissues immediately surrounding the eye, eyelids, basically. Emergency anaphylaxis, that is someone who has a severe hypersensitivity reaction to a top, whether it be a topically administered drop. That has been known. It's rare, but it can happen. If you have,
could you give me an example of that?
Well, you've heard of anaphylactic shock. An example would be someone, example we all know would be someone who is allergic to bee stings and stung by a bee. They if they know about this ahead of time, they carry with them in the summertime an EpiPen. It's a little epinephrine injection that they form it into your leg and it self-administers. And currently, optometry is not allowed to do that. So we are allowed to use topical medications that could conceivably contribute to an anaphylactic reaction. Should occur in your office.
I just needed to hear that. I mean, I think I've been on this committee every time it's come through, but I just needed to hear it again. That's not a world I travel in very often.
I also would like you to explain to the committee, because on line 5, do you have the bill in front of you? On line 5, it says a controlled substance as defined in statute 1171-900, and then in line 6, it's not a Schedule 1A controlled substance as defined. Can you tell us the
right
difference?
So you can. It would enable us to prescribe controlled substances other than the most of which are illegal, the heroin and opiate derived controlled substances.
So in line
morphine, heroin.
It says you cannot.
Cannot.
And then which controlled ones may you prescribe?
Well, any others that don't fall into that category.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I tell you, I really focused in on emergency anaphylaxis. Now, just take a scenario. Someone gets a bee sting. His eyes start swelling shut. They run him over to you because they think there's something wrong with his eyes. You are not allowed to do anything at that moment to treat emergency anaphylaxis?
No, and that's not how you're going to see it in an eye care office. I use that as an example that we'd all be familiar with of anaphylaxis, but where the big concern in an eye care office is a topically administered drop that we would administer in our office that could cause an anaphylactic reaction. So we're allowed to prescribe the drop and utilize the drop. We are not allowed to treat the reaction if the patient should have it.
I find that unbelievable. A little Benadryl, IM. You cannot do that?
No, we can't.
Hard to believe.
Representative Sisna?
Thank you very much. And I've heard that example used before in other times that we've heard this. How many times does that happen? Have we lost some people because of that?
Fortunately, it's never happened to me. I have one patient that I'm aware of that has had anaphylactic reactions to just common dilating agents. It's happened in other offices, and she's well aware of it. She's spent some time in the hospital for it and refuses politely to be dilated. So, and I certainly honor that. But so I have a patient that has that type of hypersensitivity, but fortunately was not in my office when she had that reaction. So, yeah, it's extremely rare, but it happens.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would oxycodone fall into the drug that you could prescribe?
I believe that is 1A.
Which schedule is it? 1A?
No.
So, if it falls into
Representative Samuels.
Oxycodone is 1A.
Representative Coghill, did you have your hand up?
You'd like to see the topic.
But I don't want to get in the middle of his line of questioning here. I think we probably might want to get this settled, get the chapter and verse on that.
Thank you.
I think they said it was not. It's in 1A.
Okay.
So they would not be able to prescribe it. Go ahead, Dr. Representative Coghill.
Dr. Coghill, that sounds good. One of the assertions of that I've heard over and over again is that it might jeopardize eye safety in Alaska. And I think one of the things that we have to do here in this committee, Madam Chair and Sir, is ask the question, what is good public policy? And if you watch my voting record on this, my answer is maybe, and that's final, because I've voted on both sides of this a couple of times, you know. So, because I really have been perplexed. When I talk to one of my friends who is on one side of the issue, if I'm in the room with him, he can get me to agree with him. And then if I go and talk to the other folks, they can get me to agree with them. It's because I don't understand everything there is to know. So one time, the last time we saw this, I said, let the medical board come and tell us. And that has never happened. And I have a letter here by Carl Rosen, who says the state medical board unanimously opposed SB 78, which is a companion of this, maybe different because it talks about injection in SB 78 and not in this. But can you give me some explanation from your point of view why the medical board has come out in this fashion?
Right. Well, no, you know, I'm not privy to their thoughts. I have no idea how in depth they even looked at the issue or are aware of optometric training. I personally know physicians who have expressed surprise that we did not already have these capabilities, primary care physicians. No, I really can't speak to that. What I can speak to is that we have an optometry board. And in many states, optometrists do not ask for the privilege of regulating physicians. And I really don't see the applicability of why the medical board should have the authority to regulate optometry. We have a podiatrist and other practitioners, too.
Follow-up, Representative Coghill.
You know, and we can't be experts on everything. So we do look to those who have board authority to look over licensing in many cases. And so it is a little bit out of the scope, I understand that. And I will say at least this is in 2000, so we're a couple years down from that.
Yeah, and I think there were some objections raised based on the wording about any type of injector.
But I will tell you, as a legislator who is not in the medical field, I get really uncomfortable getting into a turf battle between one authority and another when, on the very face of it, I didn't even understand what ocular meant. Though I think I could have figured that out, but it's not it's not language I speak in generally, and we were called on to do that. So as I understand it, the prescription authority that you're looking for in this bill is not dissimilar to a PA or a nurse practitioner or a dentist.
I think it's most similar to a dentist because we're restricting it to our specific area of expertise as opposed to the whole body. You know, we're not asking to be able to treat other medical conditions other than those involving the eye.
Just from, Madam Chair, if I might, just from your perspective, if you wandered off not just the schedule but prescriptions that were could be questioned as to outside of dealing just specifically with the eye, who is going to hold you accountable? What is going to be the track record on watching that?
That would fall under the optometry board, and they're a pretty conservative bunch. You know, it's the same as physicians who stray. I think there's been a couple of pretty highly publicized cases recently where folks have lost their license or been censured by their particular board.
that might be something we might want to see on, and I would ask this of, here we have one board before us, and I guess we might want to look at the ophthalmologist and find out what that authority is.
We do have someone in the audience that, so I'm trying to get one side, and then we're going to go to the other side so that we can hear both sides.
I appreciate you giving me some latitude to question here, because I really am trying to find out where is there any middle ground where we can say, this is a good public policy, we're pretty safe there. And if you have one board saying one thing and we have another board saying something else, well, you tell you what, our temptation would be to make a law combining the boards and let you fight it out. You know, quite frankly, because this has been years in debates, and so trying to find out what the solution is. So the eye safety is one thing we're concerned with. And when we hear somebody tell us this is going to jeopardize eye safety in Alaska, it rings a bell with us. And you're demonstrating to us that is not true?
That it jeopardizes eye safety? Yeah, I think it's pretty conclusive. It's not like no other state has done this before. Not all of the 40 states certainly have been there for a long time, but there have not been issues raised. There have not been any of the, you know, in 40 states, none of those laws have been rescinded. In all 50 states with topical medications, none of those have been rescinded. I would hope that speaks to a lack of problems associated with this type of legislation. Malpractice rates have not gone up. They've been affected, and they're not differentiated. So, you know, the insurance company, the bean counters, the insurance companies have not seen problems.
And one last question, then we can go to the other. One of the other assertions is this particular optometrist simply lacked the education and training to appropriately prescribe these drugs. The sponsor of the bill asserted that you do have the training and made comparisons, and we made a comparison with the dentist. I just need to hear from you that not only is disputable, but you can override that, because before I can vote on this bill, I need to understand that very clearly.
Well, I can speak to certain aspects of that. As long ago as 25 years, I was a graduate student and taught anatomy labs in Houston. I taught in the anatomy labs in the dental school, assisted in the optometry school, as well as the medical school there. The anatomy courses were the same and under the same jurisdiction. The pharmacology requirements, the textbooks are the same or similar. The number of course hours spent are remarkably similar. I think you have in your packets comparison with Harvard Medical School. It is not at all dissimilar. And certainly as far as whole body treatment, it's certainly equal to what the dental profession does.
Well,
you know, we have not been through residencies in treating gallbladders and lungs and other organs. But again, the dentists have not been either, and they've shown that they've been very safe and effective in doing what they do over a long, long period of time. And we're certainly equally educated in those areas with dentistry.
Madam Chair, and my only concern is how do we compare? And so, you know, I'm listening to you. I hear you speaking. We get to be a judge of that. But I have an assertion here that an ophthalmologist completes 4-year medical school, received a medical degree, gone through an internship and all that, and yet asserts that is more significant than the education requirements upon your licensing?
And I would agree, and we're not asking to be ophthalmologists. We're not asking for surgical rights. You know, I assume that they're spending a great deal of that time working on their surgical skills. And we're not asking for equal licensure with ophthalmology.
One of the things I'm trying to find out, Madam Chair, is
at what level of qualification can we substantiate here in this committee? And then what level of care people can receive in Alaska by both parties, because I think both parties are needed. What is a dispute over a market share, or the dollar bill, if you will, and how we get to be the judges in there to get to real good health care in Alaska. And so if you don't, I've been asking these questions, trying to discern that. When we have other people come up, I'm going to ask, you know, similar line of questioning. But at this point, I'm reluctant to move forward on it because I haven't been, I do not have a clear understanding. I think I can agree with Representative Gatto when he says it's amazing to me that I can put eye drops in my child's eye and you can't.
Well, we can put eye drops in.
And.
Okay. All right. I have, as a school teacher, had to be prepared to administer a needle to either a diabetic or a bee sting person. So, I mean, I struggle with that analogy. On the other hand, I still don't feel qualified to make a judgment call. So I'm working on it. I like I say, I've voted on both sides of this, so I really have I got no pride in this anymore, you know.
Let's go ahead and move on. thank you, Mike. I have let's have Sherry Lentzer come forward. Well, I'd kind of like to get it so that I hear what from one side, and then we can ask the questions, all the questions, and then we can hear from the other side, so we can hear the questions from everybody, so that we can kind of ask our questions. So if you want to come forward, and thank you. I've got a couple more questions, too, that I thought I would like to ask. Go ahead, Sherry, and state your name and your affiliation.
I'm Dr. Cheryl Lemfer, and I'm an optometrist in Anchorage, and from Alaska, born and raised here, and went to school in the States to come back. And, of course, I'm in support of Bill 306, and hopefully I can answer some of Representative Coghill's questions, because there are some good questions there. And I would hope that there's quite a bit of access of the information, actually, to the curriculums of the schools, and I'd really like to, if you guys are in question at all, to take a look at that, because the issue is very difficult for me of this education thing. And if that's such a question, why are the PAs and the nurse practitioners prescribing, and they're not prescribing with a doctor there right behind them every moment? They're doing it freely on their own, reporting back the PAs. So if there's a question of education, I want you, if you wouldn't mind, to look that up actually at the schools and on the internet and compare them to the medical schools, because there is no question there. That shouldn't even be an issue here. Compare it to a dentist, compare it to a podiatrist, compare it to all sorts of health care. Okay, that shouldn't be a question. But I want to cover a few issues. I want to cover who currently treats with the orals in the state of Alaska and our education relation to the professionals, the role of optometrists in primary health care, especially related to the eyes, and the need and the benefits of optometrists in Alaska. Medical doctors, osteopathic, podiatrists, dentists, nurse practitioners, physicians all have prescriptive authority to prescribe pharmaceutical agents here. Medical doctors, osteopathic doctors, podiatrists, dentists, and optometrists have the four-year doctorate degree after a qualifying 4 years of undergraduate. And this is across the board. There's no variation in that. Nurse practitioners and physician assistants have 2 years of master's worked after an undergraduate degree. And that's in physician's assistants. To my surprise, you don't have to have a four-year undergraduate degree to get into that situation. And I have no problems with them, by the way. I think they're a very good group, and it's been very beneficial to Alaska to have PAs and to have nurse practitioners. That's not my point at all. The pharmacology education between medical doctors and osteopathic doctors, which my school was part of actually a network of three, an osteopathic, a medical school, and an eye school, are the same. optometric education, like I said before, shouldn't be a question. Optometrists provide more than 70% of the primary eye care in America. And when you consider this percentage, when there's many vocations treating eye disease, nurses, PAs, and physicians and eye surgeons, that's a big number that we're providing. And you think about Alaska, it's even greater here. There's 103 optometrists serving Alaska in 17 different locations, and we travel a lot. Many optometrists travel outside their community to treat patients. Some advantages of as a primary care physician is that is our availability. It is common for an optometrist to be open Monday through Saturday with extended hours and on-call pagers. There are only 28 eye surgeons in 6 different locations, most of which do surgery. And with a state population of over 500,000, their availability and accessibility has been a big challenge for this state. This has put more demand on optometrists to practice to our fullest training. And that's another statement Representative Coghill made. This is not new training or any additional training. We've been trained in this. I was prescribing coming out in 96 from my school. So none of this is new, and you know, do we have to add addition to it? No. We are going to, for those of us who haven't been able to use prescriptive authority in the last several years ourselves, our board is going to require of us to pass, last time it was over 100 hours for the eye drops, so it'll probably be over 200 hours, go through coursework and pass a test, then get a therapeutic endorsement on our license. So if you don't pass the test, you can't automatically prescribe. And when you get out of, you can't automatically prescribe in the state just because we're an OD now. You would have to graduate in the last 2 years. We have a very conservative board, and that's what happened with the therapeutic eye drops. You couldn't just all of a sudden, okay, the bill passed, we're going to do therapeutic eye drops. It was, nope, our board said, nope, you've got to prove it to us that you're okay because we don't want any mess-ups. We're very conservative up here. To answer that question, and Alaska has benefited from the prescriptive authorities of dentists and podiatrists and nurse practitioners. I think we all can attest to that, and PAs. The legislation for optometrists and the use of pharmaceutical agents used the treatment of ocular disease and ocular nexus disease or conditions or anaphylaxis. You can see how serious we are about preserving our treatment to eye-related conditions. If we really wanted to be, you know, huge on this, we wouldn't make it eye-related conditions. We'd say we were going to just have broad-spectrum pharmaceuticals like PAs or nurse practitioners, and we're not asking for that. We want it strictly for the reasons in which we're trained and what we're practicing. One thing that's a little bit confusing to me is that there are healthcare providers in the state, which some are less educated, that have prescriptive authority where we don't. The demand for eye care professionals in the state is huge, and especially in primary care. With our education and our knowledge and training, you can see how difficult it is for our patients physically as well as financially to be sent from our offices to another practitioner's office to receive treatment that we prescribed. And sometimes this requires traveling distances. And that's something that is as common as Mike was mentioning earlier, you have zosters. And I don't know if anyone of you have ever had shingles or zosters, but it's a very uncomfortable situation. And I had one at 4 o'clock on a Saturday, couldn't call anyone for any orals. The treatment is best within 48 to 72 hours of oral treatment. The patient was very angry with me. And I said, hey, it's not my authority in the state to be able to do this. And it was very difficult for us to find a practitioner that was available in town to give him orals. And even called this place in Saldatna, is willing to drive back to Saldatna to find someone to give him some orals. So these are the situations just in primary care. We're not asking for surgery or any injections to the eye, which I heard one of you mention earlier. Is this injectables to the eye? Absolutely not. We're not asking for that. It's dangerous and risky for even ophthalmology. You know, it's a touchy situation, and you want to be specialists in that area to do anything like that. We're so conservative by our history in this state. We have not done anything radical in this state. We've always checked each other. Our board has been very tight. So there's very good regulation on us, self-imposed. And in fact, Representative Coghill, we went to the medical board after Knowles vetoed it. And we had a meeting. We did everything that Knowles asked us to do, and there was no cohesiveness. But opposition from the specific eye surgeons group, and I don't know his name, but the medical doctor up in Nome at the time said, hey, I call the optometrist here all the time to come in. He is my eye specialist. So there was never a conclusive issue. And in fact, we have from the Alaska AMA, I'm not sure exactly how to call that, they were in a neutral position, that we talked to them. We try to talk to them full out, because this so-called turf war, which is difficult for me to hear since so many of the surgeons I grew up knowing, is not a reason to make a judgment on this bill. The better health care for Alaska is a reason to make a judgment on this bill and what is right for the Alaskans. Do you have any questions, Al?
I do have some, Sherry. I've worked, I used to live in Tok, and I worked in the clinic there, and the full 4 years I either had a PA or an advanced nurse practitioner that were prescribing. They were under the umbrella of an MD. And so I have a question. You didn't want to be at all under someone else because of the the you being able to prescribe, and the other ones are. I mean, I know that PAs are, and so are advanced nurse practitioners. They have to work under someone else. But you guys don't want to do that.
For a 4-year doctorate degree program, I mean, you're asking a dentist to work under a medical dentist. You know, it's the same comparison.
I'm not talking about the dentist. I'm talking about the PAs and the advanced nurse practitioners.
If we were to go under an umbrella, I mean, it's kind of silly. I mean, who are we going to go an umbrella with? You know, if what, just ophthalmologist? That doesn't make sense. Because we're a practicing entity. We have an established board that's been in this state for, boy, Sam would probably even know how many years that the board has been in this state. Regulating board, very excellent history. And that's what the boards are established for. And we actually made the attempt, our board and us made the attempt of the medical board to communicate on this issue, because it's just becoming so drawn out. And they weren't even willing to, not the board, but certain portions of the board weren't willing to bend on that. You know, we're educated in this situation.
It is? Oh, I'm sorry. I saw the C and the G, and I said, looks like mine.
Okay, I guess my statement is, sorry. We're educated in this situation. And if there's a doubt in your mind about our education and our ability to prescribe, then I really need you to research that out and look at it. Because we're not with nurse practitioners, we're not with PAs. We are up with dentists, with MDs, the same pharmacological education. So why is ours in question, is my question to you.
Well, because that you haven't gone into the specialty area, and so the people that haven't had that extra training in other areas are under someone. Just a question. Okay, I'll ask that same question later on.
And I'll answer that, because what happens to us, and you can look at our curriculum, and this is where my friend who is a GP in Anchorage who went to Hahnemann, which was my affiliate school, medical school, laughed at me. I was taking human anatomy, neural anatomy, physiology, pathology, all those classes, and ocular biology, ocular physiology, eye classes in addition at the same time. Third year or fourth year, depending on the medical school you go to, you go into a series of rotations. You're going to find out if you want to be a pediatrician, you're going to find out if you want to be a gynecologist, and so on. We don't. We know we're going to be eye doctors. So we go into seeing patients our third year already. And at my school, the first year ophthalmology residents were under us in emergency care as a fourth year student, because we had been through all that. So we got to train them on their first year of care, introduce them to, here's eye emergency care. So they're going through school learning about the whole body and not specializing. We're going through school learning about the body, but also already specializing. We have so many patient hours by the time we get out our third year and into our fourth year is all patient clinical hours. We're over 2,000 patient hours before we get out. That's really darn good for any healthcare profession.
Anybody else have any questions? Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paramedics in Anchorage, after only a year of sporadic training, give intracardiac drugs during ventricular fibrillation. And it's not only allowed, it's essential. So there is precedent for other groups who are doing what you're asking to be able to do, is just do something that's really pretty significant. And that's not oral. I mean, we're talking much, much beyond oral medication. So with that in mind, I kind of couldn't help but look at Carl Rose's letter. and he made a couple of statements that I want you to comment on. First one he said is, 306 is a bill that jeopardizes patient eye safety. Second thing he says, optometrists do not have clinical experience to safely administer eye injections. And lastly, and the killer, for optometrists still would endanger patients. I'm dying to hear how you respond to this.
Well, for one, nothing in this bill says anything about eye injections, not a thing. So there's no way any of us want to do eye injections. It's just way beyond what we want to do. When you get to that point.
I'm sorry, I kind of want to just interrupt here just a little bit to explain. I think all of us were under a little bit of a guidance here, because our sponsor statements that we've had all along say prescribed oral or injectable medications, and so we kind of were under the idea that that's what it was, and so that's kind of in our heads, and so we misunderstood that for a while.
We're not asking for injectables here.
So, and I think we just got an update today, and that got changed. But that's, I think, how come everybody's kind of zeroing in on that. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that just explained it a little bit.
Like, yeah. We're not asking for injectables whatsoever. That is a very technical, risky thing, and that is not something that we want to venture into at all. And nor is our training for that. You know, when you're talking about eye injections, you're talking about doing something significant to the globe, usually invasive procedure, and that is for a surgeon. It's like your general physician saying, I'm going to do heart surgery on you. No, he's not qualified for that. And the same with us. We're qualified in a general practitioner of the eye, but we're not doing surgery. You know, that's where the specialists are for. And we sure need them, and we use them a lot, a whole lot. A majority of us work very well together, and that's how it should be. I want to hear those other two again so I can respond.
Okay. It had to do with, I have it tagged here. Does not have the clinical experience to safely administer eye injections. Strike that one. An expanded scope of practice for optometrists still would endanger patients.
I'd like to hear his response to that too, because you tell me that I have someone sitting in my chair with a pressure, and a very high elevated pressure, who could go blind immediately, and I go, oh, sorry, I can't prescribe to you. This is before we had topicals. That would endanger the eye. This is the same argument they had back before we had topicals. Now I have someone with angle closure, going into angle closure, and I live in Homer. I'm going to have to get on the phone to someone in Anchorage and say, hey, can I give him an oral Diamox, which is something that will get the pressure down very quickly. I have to ask. I have to call someone and ask. No, and I can't get a hold of him. Now we're looking a half an hour later. That person is going to lose sight. Absolutely. So the fact that I can't give them something right away and I have to call around, that is a risk and danger to the patient's eye. Now, I'm not sure, I don't understand how, because we have so much knowledge on the eye, how we can be endangering them when we can treat them better.
Unfollow. I don't like that grin on your face.
I don't want an answer. It's a rhetorical question. But if you can't get hold of somebody and they're going to lose their sight in 2 hours, would you or wouldn't you? Don't answer. I have to leave.
Representative Cockles, did you want to follow up at all?
This is probably a little different line of questioning. One of the questions came as I was reading through the backup material on this, with the extended use of steroids and how that might affect both the eye or the rest of the body. That was put up as one of the first present dangers of allowing this bill to go through. I'd like to have a response, because I do not understand, and I don't know that any of us here, maybe with the exception of Ms. Peggy, the chairman, on how that could affect eye safety and how you might be involved in using them under this bill.
Probably we're not going to use them under this bill much, unless I'm in somewhere rural and I'm in a call in conjunction with a general physician or an ophthalmologist and say, hey, I'm worried about some optic nerve swelling here, and let me explain to you what's going on, and do you think I should prescribe this right away and get him to see you? Steroid use orally, this happens often to us. A general physician will prescribe oral steroids, and they come in, and all of a sudden we take the pressure of our patient, and their eye pressure is way elevated. There are people who are steroid responders. We typically offshoot that. We typically catch that when a general physician often forgets a lot to say, oh, when you're on a steroid, you better get your eye pressure checked. Okay? So it's steroids are not oral steroid is not something that we want to treat with commonly, and nor in practice, I doubt we're ever going to treat without calling someone. You know, that's not a concern.
But that's a professional barrier that you feel would always be present if you were allowed at this point to administer that. There's still and I just want to know from doctor to doctor, do that training level is there, because the charge is made that could be a significant problem.
If we use steroids, it's not going to be something that any of us are going to want to be comfortable using, guaranteed. That's a serious drug. Has serious side effects, which I'm sure you guys know through just treatments of other diseases with steroids. So that is one of those things that when it comes time to cross that bridge, we feel like there needs to be steroid involved in treatment. We're going to be either referring or calling. I mean, that's one of those drugs way up there. Most of the drugs that we're going to be using are going to be antibiotics and antivirals, maybe some low-dose pain medicines, removing foreign bodies, those sort of things to get patients comfortable. If they really need it, that's the part.
Madam Chair, that led me to the next question. I think you answered that one sufficiently. In my reading of backup material, over-prescribing antibiotics is also a concern I saw in the backup material I had. Where are you now? What would this change? What are the concerns to be addressed here?
I think those concerns would belong with every single healthcare profession right there. And in the whole healthcare as a whole, the worry about over-prescribing antibiotics is huge. And we all know that. And that is what we're given as a professional judgment as doctors of optometry going through all the school and taking your oath. It's our definite professional judgment of whether we to be careful about that. We read the journals. We go to CE. We take 48 hours of CE. And I can't remember exactly how many.
CE stands for?
Continuing Ed, I'm sorry. You know, a year. You have to maintain your license by that. A board watches that. It's not as if we have our education, now we're off on our own. It's a dynamic, medicine's a dynamic process. And through each CE, you learn about the effectiveness of a drug or the lack of effectiveness of a drug. What's doing better in this disease? Resistance to medications? It's the same thing with general physicians. Same thing.
Hello.
I'm still trying to get some idea of parameters here, so I appreciate the latitude in questions and your willingness to answer. And I'll look forward to the other side, But help me understand from your perspective when the idea of systemic drugs comes to the debate. Once again, it goes back to the qualification, I understand, but how does that actually work out in the effective practice if you're given this opportunity to really could affect the rest of the body system, if I understand correctly?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one side of that is no matter what oral medications you prescribe, you always have to know that there's side effects. You always have to be aware of contraindications with medicines, with other systemic medicines the patients are taking. So you have to be, and their health condition, do they have any liver diseases, there's any problems with their kidneys, those sort of things. Those are all things you have to take into account when you prescribe a medicine. So given that, how are we going to use it in the practice? Well, my example before, this patient had the zosters, and he was very uncomfortable and very angry with me. What would I do? I'd institute treatment within the period of time I need to, oral antivirals for him. Pain medicine if he needed it. If he needed it. That's one of those things, too, where we're conservative about, you really got to be in a lot of pain. Then what's my next step? This has become a systemic thing, zosters. I'm treating the eye, but now I get him to his general physician. Okay, I take care of that surface of the eye, institute him on that, call his general physician and say, here, this is what I started him on Saturday. It's Monday in your office. Here's what he's been doing, and pass him on, because now we're dealing with the systemic thing.
One last question, and then I'll back off. Right. In our discussion up on the fifth floor on trying to get our prescription drug thing under control and all that, one of the things we hear in debate is I don't even know what the technical word for it is, but it's how the interaction of various different drugs take effect. Certainly, we're talking about two different levels of pharmacology, I would imagine, in this. So help me understand what that level is. And one of the things I read here is that with seniors taking as many medications as they are, that there could be some side effects that would be health damaging. So help me understand a little bit of that.
Let's start back at school. That's where you learn everything in school. We don't learn pharmacology, hey, this is aspirin. You know, it's a drug you take for pain. You learn the whole mechanism of action of every drug, classifications of drugs, offshoot, side effect, contraindication, what drugs you can't take them with. So that's all part of our education. So now when you get a patient in there, every single form, exam form that we have, you fill out, there's a whole list on what medication this patient's taking them and why nowadays. Because now you have three or four different reasons why an oral medication's taking. All that is important and necessary. What's your systemic health? Tell me what's going on. Oh, you're an eye doctor. I don't need to tell you. No, I need to know if you have high blood pressure. I need to know, you know, you have any liver dysfunction. I need to know anything about your general health before I even give you an eye exam. That's something we find out. So if I am prescribing some drugs, you most certainly bet I'm looking at those other drugs and going, can I prescribe? That's a consideration. There aren't tons of drugs. Do I want to prescribe a drug? I mean, we call it drug salad. When a patient walks in and they have so many drugs that they're on, last thing you want to do, even an eye drop. You don't even want to add an eye drop to this patient. They're on so many medicines. So yes, we consider it all. Is our education different than the general physician doing it? No. We have that, again, that same education there, that same pharmacology, same breakdown, same mechanism of action, same contraindications, other uses of the drug. We get the same thing, and we're privy to the same information. You know, so of course, with the technology and updates, now you can have a Palm Pilot in your hand and look at it and compare.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I took up a lot of time, but you know, that's
okay.
I feel like I'm probably sitting on the hot seat here too, a little bit.
I have to say that I'm kind of I was on one side at the beginning of this day, and now I'm kind of on the other side. I had a personal experience that's made this, and that's why I kind of too wanted to really dig into this. I know that you keep saying over and over and over that we have the same training, the same training, the same training, but an MD goes into different systems, you know, and so you know, when they go into diabetes, they go into a whole session and a whole long-term range of the ramifications of diabetes and how it affects the different organs and everything like that. And then they go, for every disease, they go into a lot more and how everything interconnects. And I guess that's a concern that I have because of that very thing. I probably would feel more comfortable if you were under the umbrella of someone that has that type of training, rather than insisting that you're under your own group. And that's why, because I know they have an overall look at the body system, you know, in a way that is definitely more intensified than you guys do.
And have you been able to compare that?
Yeah, I have talked with people. I haven't actually looked it up, but I have talked about it, and I've read some of this. But I mean, that's kind of where I'm coming from, I guess, kind of with Representative Coghill.
Can I make a follow-up comment to that?
You may.
Where do they do this extra? Is it in school or is it beyond school? That would be my question of who you've talked to.
I guess I'm not that concerned where they get, how they got the extra training. You know, I mean, they have it, so that's what I'm concerned about. Because they go into sometimes, of course, obviously, if they're in a specialist area,
right.
If they're an intern, or, you
if
know.
If they're general, they know they're going into, say, being an eye surgeon. And that's the other thing. When you go get your medical degree and you go into eye surgery, we're not doing eye surgery. They do spend all those extra special training for surgery. It's a whole different ball of wax. It's a whole different ball game. Secondary and tertiary care, absolutely. We're not asking for, you know, surgery or anything like that. We're asking for primary care. But we do in school. In physiology, the same as in medical school. Same teacher, same textbook in my school, anyway. same physiology, same diabetes issues. You go on all the way to the different levels, the different implications of it. We go through the whole systemic health in our school. So that's why I asked that. I mean, that argument would be very valid with me if it was after school, and part of residency for becoming an eye doctor is to spend 10 months getting diabetic training also and 10 months doing that. We're primary care, just like a general physician. Look at it, say, hey, your diabetic retinopathy is getting to a point I need to refer you to a specialist. You know, that's what we do. We're a gateway, like your general physician. You wouldn't ask him to do heart surgery on you, nor would you expect him to.
Thank you, Cheryl. I appreciate it. We've got some other people online. I'd like to hear from them. I've really given some latitude here, and I've done it for a reason, because I want each side to really be able to explain and to be able to see where you're coming from. And so if we don't have any more comments on this side, now I would like to hear from the other side, and I hope that we do the same kind of drill. Because I want to make sure that both we hear both sides and really become well informed on this. So I hope that we still have people online. We have taken quite a while. Bob Palmer, are you online?
Yes. So I was just going. I'm with the American Academy of Ophthalmology, and I was just for reference with Dr. Rosen and Dr. Bradford.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Dr. Bradford. Are you online?
Yes, ma'am.
Would you go ahead and state your name and your affiliation, and then go ahead and go into reasons that you feel you're on the other side of the equation here?
All right. My name is Cynthia Bradford. I'm Secretary for State Affairs for the American Academy of Ophthalmology, and I appreciate you allowing me to join you by phone. I am speaking on behalf of the American Academy of Ophthalmology and its 26,000 members. I'm a physician volunteer with the Academy, and the Academy joins the Alaska State Ophthalmology Society in opposing House Bill 306. The bill before you is very short, but has major eye health ramifications for the citizens of Alaska. Before I go into my discussion, I'd like to highlight my professional training to give you a perspective on my comments. I'm a physician, I'm an ophthalmologist, and associate professor of ophthalmology at the Department of Ophthalmology, OU College of Medicine in Oklahoma City. I've been active throughout my career teaching medical school graduates the skills that are necessary to become qualified specialists in eye care. I'm the executive editor for the American Academy of Ophthalmology's text, Basic Ophthalmology, which is used to teach students in most medical schools in the United States and has been translated into both Chinese and Russian languages. I'm coordinator for the medical student and primary care resident education in ophthalmology at the University of Oklahoma. Finally, although it seems like my teaching career began just yesterday, I have, over the past 15 years, taught ophthalmology residents in Oklahoma to perform cataract surgery. First of all, the Academy and I would like to commend each of you for the public service you provide, working to ensure the Alaskans receive the highest quality of medical services. The questions you're asking are not easy and require much thought. I know you've already read the letter from Dr. Rosen, who's expressed his views of the ophthalmic community in Alaska, and the Academy would like to reinforce those concerns. The Academy believes that expanding the scope of practice to include oral drugs, I thought it was injectable drugs also, I heard the earlier conversation, and controlled substances is a serious public health issue, and none of us take that lightly. On the surface, it may appear congruent to arguments allowing optometrists to prescribe these drugs, but closer scrutiny unveils significant quality of care and patient safety issues to be considered. It is impossible to divorce the eye and the visual system from the rest of the body because it's a part of the body. Many diseases of other systems manifest themselves in the eye or in vision function. To make the right diagnosis and to provide appropriate medical or surgical care requires years of professional training. training an accredited program. I'm sure almost all of you are aware that this is at least 3 years beyond medical school and internship for ophthalmology. Like all the rest of medicine, this is a requirement to develop the necessary skills for problem solving and sound clinical judgment. Remember, the eye is not a tooth. It's one of the most complex and delicate and important body parts that we have. It may be small, but each part is extremely important and can have a variety of disease processes that must be correctly identified in order to be correctly treated. Simply put, optometrists do not have comparable education, training, or experience to use the broad range of drugs that House Bill 306 would authorize. We cannot treat serious disease separate from the understanding of the whole body, and medical school does uniquely provide this knowledge base. Let's briefly look at some of the drugs authorized. I think you've talked about steroids. Steroids can lead to permanent joint damage, aseptic necrosis, that can require surgical intervention. We've already talked about the antibiotics can lead to resistant organisms. And controlled substances can be subject to abuse. During my internship, I got vast experience in prescribing controlled substances. As I tell my residents now, that oftentimes, if you think you're going to give a narcotic, you best rethink what you're prescribing it for. It's very rare to require a narcotic for an eye condition. Most often used narcotic in eye care is following surgery. Moreover, since seniors have serious eye medical conditions as well as chronic illness and often less tolerant to drug side effects, careful evaluation and close coordination by an ophthalmologist for the other medical treatments is essential. 4 years of optometry school does not equate to 8 years of ophthalmology training and education. Not only do optometrists not possess a medical degree, they're not required to complete clinical rounds, internships, and residencies that focus on patients with serious eye disease. Let me contrast this with the typical training and experience of an ophthalmologist. Ophthalmologists must complete 4 years of medical school. Afterwards, the medical school graduate must also complete an intensive one-year hospital residency, consolidating and honing the knowledge and skills in the art of medicine. Only then does the physician begin a three-year ophthalmology residency in order to concentrate on eye disease. As a result of this training, ophthalmologists graduate confident, prescribing systemic drugs when needed for patients who seek their help. Just as importantly, because of this education and training, their patients trust them to prescribe drugs safely and appropriately. As an ophthalmologist who's trained ophthalmologists for many years, it's important for me to ensure that the citizens of your state receive appropriate medical eye care. Limiting optometrists to the tasks for which they're competent is in the best interest of patients. There is a difference in education, and that's reflected in the licenses of the two professions. Optometrists are valued members of the eye care team. However, they do not obtain a medical degree, and with that training, the judgment, knowledge, and skills to be authorized the broad prescription authority that House Bill 306 would grant. I ask you again to please oppose House Bill 306, and I appreciate you allowing me to share my statement with you.
Thank you, Dr. Bradford. Does anybody have any questions for her? Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Dr. Bradford. One of the things that we're trying to get to is the differing levels of training. And you said there was a four-year compared to an eight-year education. But in the discussion of this, I'm trying to figure out the time that is spent on pharmacology and the time that you might spend in the ophthalmology on surgical training that might take up that extra 4 years. Can you give me some idea of how much time that would take of that next 4 years, including, I suppose, that internship that you're talking about?
Well, I guess I have to begin at the beginning. There's a pharmacology course, and you do learn the basics of medications, indications, contraindications. But along with that, not only the pharmacology, you have to understand what is the disease process, how does it occur, and that's in pathology. And in physiology, you learn how the body parts are supposed to work. You learn the chemistry of all that. You learn the different places it can go wrong and how the drugs interact there. So those are kind of the basic background. And then as you move into the clinical years, you start applying this paperwork that you've learned. And it's a whole different world to decide which medicine to give and the possible side effects and see them happen and realize that there's a downside to every medication, but also sometimes there's a justifiable need for the medication. And that's where going through the clinical years in medical school, you learn about it. So you have 2 years.